Well, as you will see, have seen from your program card, every now and again in these come together times, out of term time, when we meet together on a Sunday night, we look at something that's in the news recently and try to reflect on it from a Christian and biblical point of view. And the particular item in the news that I thought we would usefully look at tonight, perhaps for just a few moments, is this much vexed issue of the ordination of women in the Church of England. It really hit the headlines in a big way last weekend, as I expect you noticed. Just about every serious newspaper had leading articles about it. It was on March the 12th that the Bishop of Bristol ordained 32 women as priests of the Church of England. Actually, not quite such a world-shattering event as those newspapers seem to make out, because when you think of Anglicanism as a worldwide phenomenon, rather than just something localized here in this country, there have been women priests in Anglican churches worldwide for many years. But here in England, where, of course, Anglicanism began, there has been considerable resistance to the idea, and indeed there still is. Because, as you probably also read in your newspaper, just a few days before that service in Bristol, in York Minster, John Gainsford was consecrated as what's been called a flying bishop. I'm not quite sure that conveys the right idea, but anyway, that's what they're calling him, to look after the clergy of the Church of England who are opposed to the priesthood of women. And, of course, we've also read recently of several prominent Anglicans, prominent in public life, who have not even been satisfied by that concession to the anti-women's ordination group in the Church of England. People like John Gummer and others have left the Church of England altogether. And they have decided to join the Church of Rome. Now, it's that particular response to this complex situation I want to consider tonight, under this title, What's on the News? Of course, the question of the role of women in the church has been discussed here at Eden before. I have preached a number of sermons on it, which are all available in the tape library, for those of you who really have that masochistic temperament to want to listen to them. And, in fact, our church, a year or so ago, formulated its policy on this matter. And if you're really keen to know, then I'm sure Pat Blake, our administrator, will dig out the relevant document from our files and let you see it. I've got no intention tonight of exhuming all those old bones again. But to leave the Church of England in order to join the Church of Rome seems to me, whatever you think about the issue of women's role in the church, a decidedly mistaken move. And I felt it was important to try to explain to you why I feel that's there. You could almost say I think it's leaping from the theological frying pan into the theological fire. At least it is for anybody whose Christian faith is ordered by the Bible. Indeed, I think that the decision to respond in that way to this situation actually highlights a very profound irony within the Church of England itself. For you see, women in the Church of England already can do just about anything that you would probably predicate of a minister of a church. Women can lead worship. They can engage in pastoral counseling. They can baptize children, marry couples, bury the dead. They can preach. Nothing that happened last weekend has changed any of that. Women have been able to do these things in the Church of England for a long, long while. The only thing a woman has not been able to do hitherto in the Church of England is to utter the words of consecration and blessing at a service of Holy Communion. That's all this formidable controversy has really been about, in terms of ministerial function, at any rate. That's the only thing these 32 women are now able to do, which a woman has not previously been able to do. Now, you may ask yourself, why on earth the Church of England has, having given permission for women to do all these other things, yet balked at what seems like a comparatively trivial thing, to say a few liturgical words over bread and wine and a communion service? Why make such a fuss about that, when women are allowed to do all these other things which seem so much more fundamental and important and demanding? Well, in order to understand that, we have to understand a little bit about Catholic theology. Now, there are some people, of course, who just don't like any kind of discussion in public of the divisive elements within the Christian Church. I understand that. I don't like it myself, particularly. But just now and again, if we are going to understand a controversy within the Church, we have also to be frank about those things that divide Christians. And there is an issue that divides Christians of very fundamental importance that underlies this comparatively rather, this rather bizarre situation of women being ordained simply to enable them to say half a dozen words over a communion table. And it's that fundamental issue that's at stake that I think we must identify. So let me give you very rapidly an outline, first of Catholic and then a Protestant doctrine of salvation, because that's really what it's all about. Protestants have sometimes, I think, exaggerated the degree to which the Church of Rome has departed from a biblical faith. Unlike a lot of Protestant theologians I could name you, certainly in this century, the Church of Rome has always confessed the full deity of Jesus Christ and the atoning purpose of his death on the cross. The Church of Rome has always insisted upon that. The grace of God is available for sinners by virtue of Christ's sacrifice. Every Catholic knows that is true. The question at issue, though, is how is that grace, that mercy, that forgiveness of God, which Jesus has made available through his death on the cross, how is that going to be communicated to the needy person who feels in need of that grace, in need of that forgiveness? The Catholic answer to that, well, let me read to you just a few lines from a handbook on Catholic doctrine entitled This is the Faith, written by Father Francis Ripley. The purpose of this book is to catechize converts to Catholicism. It therefore represents a very, very sort of a conservative and orthodox statement of Catholic doctrine. This is what he says. The redemption of the human race was accomplished through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. As eternal high priest, he offered himself on the cross as a victim to his Father. Christ substituted himself for us, taking our punishment on himself. Now, up to that point, no conservative Christian, Bible-believing Christian could find any fault. Those are words that you could find on the lips of Martin Luther or John Calvin without without any distortion, I think. But then comes the crunch. The value of Christ's act of atonement infinitely exceeds all human sin. But it is not true to say that without change in ourselves, we can be saved simply by reminding God of his Son's sacrifice. No, God has appointed certain definite channels by which the merits of Christ's death are applied to our souls. These channels are called sacraments. So what Father Ripley is saying there is that God's forgiveness is readily available, but in order to obtain it, you have to go through the appropriate channels. And the appropriate channels, he says, are the sacramental system of the Church. Just how important sacraments are in the Roman Church is perhaps indicated in this book that I've mentioned to you. 15 pages deal with the person of Jesus and the meaning of the cross. 118 pages are dedicated to the sacraments of the Church. That's the balance of interest within the book. Of them, Father Ripley writes, "The sacraments are the veins of the mystical body of Christ." Or to use a rather more mundane analogy, he thinks of the sacraments as the plumbing system, whereby the grace of God, which is thought of like a fluid, is channeled to the needy person. The sacrament is the pipe. What are the sacraments? Well, baptism and the Mass, or Holy Communion, are very important sacraments. There are, in addition, in the Roman Catholic Church, a further five, but those are perhaps the best known and the ones most familiar to us. It's through those sacraments But the death of Christ and the forgiveness that he's made available is mediated to the individual. Indeed, Father Ripley argues that Christ's purpose in coming was to set up an institution called the Church, with a capital C, an organization on earth, through which his saving work could be dispensed to the world. The apostles constituted the first nucleus of that church. Those apostles, as they began to die, were appointed successors to themselves in the bishops of the church, apostolic successors, who possessed the same authority they did as the vehicles for the grace of God to others. And those bishops in turn consecrate priests who have the same kind of authority. For a Catholic, it's vital then that a sacrament should be a valid sacrament, that it should achieve this purpose, this saving purpose that God invests in it, that it should validly communicate God's forgiveness to the individual. And that, says Catholic theology, can only be guaranteed when the sacrament is performed by a priest. A priest who stands in succession from those apostles who were the nucleus of the church which Jesus himself set up on earth. Now, you may say, well, that begins maybe to explain why it is that these words spoken over the bread and wine are of such importance. If you take this view of how salvation reaches the individual, then to be a priest and to be able to utter those words of consecration which make this communion service a valid communion service that actually can communicate God's forgiveness to people, that's huge power. And to deny women access to that power obviously has big implications as far as your view of the sexes are concerned. But maybe you're saying all this is about the Catholic view, the view of the Church of Rome. This is how the Church of Rome understands salvation. We're talking about the Church of England. Now, the Church of England is a Protestant church, isn't it? Well, yes and no. That's the answer to that. A little church history really is required to sort that one out. History that takes us back to that famous character, Martin Luther. Martin Luther, up until the age of 34, was a passionate adherent of the Catholic Church. You couldn't have found a more zealous Catholic than he. He was a man who'd always been troubled by his own sense of sin and by the fear of judgment. And because he was a Catholic, because he believed the grace of God was piped to the individual through the plumbing system of the church's ritual, it was to those rituals, to those sacraments, he turned to seek assurance of forgiveness. As an infant, he'd been baptized. As a child a little older, a young adult, he'd been confirmed. Every week he went to Mass, believing that the offering of the real body and blood of Christ by the priest on the altar could enable his sins to be forgiven. Yet all of that wasn't enough for Luther. He felt his sins to be so serious and so persistent, he needed more grace than these three channels could deliver. And that meant penance. Penance was the fourth sacrament laid down by the Catholic Church. It's the means by which sins of a more serious nature committed after baptism are forgiven. Three conditions are required of the penitent who asks the priest for forgiveness through penance. The first is contrition, that is, you have to feel sorry for your sins. The second is confession, that is, you have to frankly accuse yourself in the presence of the priest. And the third is satisfaction, that is, some performance of some punishment or chastisement laid down by the priest to show that you really mean it. Luther launched into penance like a hungry man devouring food. He would sometimes confess for 6 hours on end till he'd worn his confessor out. But Luther, again, just didn't find assurance of forgiveness this way. Though he performed all kinds of penances and confessed his sins for hours on end, he still didn't feel assured that he was forgiven. In the end, at the age of 22, one sultry day, he was caught in a thunderstorm, thrown to the ground by a flash of lightning. He took it to be a judgment from God, and he cried out, "St. Anne, help me, I will become a monk." Now, to take holy orders is the fifth sacrament of the Catholic Church. And again, it is reckoned to transmit some special grace from God. Luther says himself that he hoped, by taking on the vow of a monk, he would at last find assurance of forgiveness. But again, it didn't work. His contrition was never sincere enough. His confession was never complete enough. His satisfaction was never sufficient enough. Even in the cloister and the monastery, he found himself beset by this grievous sense of his own moral failure. Well, he'd employed 5 of the 7 sacraments. Only marriage and extreme unction were left. The first was excluded by his vow of celibacy, and the second was excluded by the fact he wasn't dying yet. So what else could he do? Well, there was only one thing else he could do, and that was a thing called seek indulgences. The medieval Catholic Church had this idea that all the good works of the really righteous Christians were stored up in a big treasury, and people who were a bit morally deficient could ask the Church, and some of this treasury of merit, as it was called, could be laid to their account to sort of offset their failures. There were various ways you could obtain these indulgences from the Church. Usually it involved some act of veneration or obedience, or maybe providing some financial assistance to the Church. The Pope had ordained many of these indulgences, and quite a lot of them centered on doing things of a ritual nature in Rome itself. So off Martin Luther went to Rome, where he did everything which the Church said he could do in order to obtain indulgences. He viewed the sacred relics, he visited the sacred shrines. Finally, he climbed the sacred stairs of Pilate's Judgment Hall, which Catholics believed were transferred from Jerusalem to Rome. And it is said that as he climbed those stairs on his knees, as required by the indulgence, kissing each stair for good measure on the way up, when he got to the top, he suddenly found, to his consternation and shock, that he was overwhelmed again by the most appalling doubt. "I wonder if it is so," he says. Even Rome had failed to silence this anguished conscience of his. So he went back to his monastery more hopeless than ever. There was only one thing on his side in all this, and that was the Father Superior of his order of Augustinian monks. This man seems to have been a wise pastor. He gave Luther a very wise piece of advice. He told him to leave the monastery, go to the University of Wittenberg, and do a doctoral thesis on biblical studies. Martin Luther was amazed. He said such academic work would kill him. But his principal said, "That's quite all right. God has plenty of work for clever blokes like you to do." And so that was what happened. 1513 or something, Mark will tell you the date, I'm sure. Luther began to study the Bible, really for the first time in his life, in earnest, in the University of Wittenberg. And that's when at last he made his great discovery. He seems to have made it, particularly while studying that very passage from Romans chapter 1 that we read earlier. Remember what it says? "I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. For in it a righteousness from God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith." Those words shattered Luther's previous theological ideas. For Paul there, summing up the essence of the way of salvation, Luther suddenly realized, was flatly contradicting those ideas which he had imbibed from the Church. Paul did not say there that salvation was obtained through the sacraments. He said the gospel was the power of God to salvation, the gospel message. Not baptism, not communion, not the Church's ritual. The message of Christ's coming and death and resurrection for sinners. This word had the power of salvation impregnated into itself without any additional need for ecclesiastical plumbing. And that the needy sinner could receive the righteousness of God, which was promised in that gospel, by faith. Not by sacraments, by faith. So a whole new understanding of the way of salvation was born. Pretty soon, Luther began to teach it and to write about it. And very quickly, others who had access to the text of the New Testament began to see the self-evident nature of it, that this was the religion of the Bible, so different from the religion of the Church. A salvation mediated not by church sacraments, but by faith in the gospel message. It brought with it, of course, a completely new understanding of the church. No longer was the church an authoritative, centralized institution through which this salvation was administered, like the cistern in your plumbing system in the house. From now on, the church began to become a fellowship of individuals who had found this experience of saving faith and shared, therefore, a new relationship with God as a result of it. The minister, who formerly had been a priest, a representative of this authoritative central church with a capital C, now became a preacher whose task was to proclaim the gospel rather than to perform the sacraments. And the central feature of the church's architecture, which had once been the altar where the Mass was celebrated, became now the pulpit where the gospel word was taught. In short, that whole system of medieval Catholic ritualism and ecclesiastical authority was overturned. These ideas of Martin Luther, of course, came to England. In fact, they came to Cambridge. I don't know if you realize it, but Cambridge played an absolutely crucial part in those early days of the Reformation in England. For it was a little public house, a little inn, more or less opposite where Corpus Christi is now, called the White Horse Inn. It was there that some Cambridge scholars first began to read in German some of the pamphlets of Luther, which had been brought over from the continent, and to become excited by his teaching. And many of the most prominent leaders of the Reformation in England were Cambridge scholars as a result of that. But, it has to be said, though that Reformation came to England and eventually transformed the church in England, it never quite did so completely. There was a struggle for the best part of two centuries within the Church of England between those who had embraced Luther's discovery of salvation through faith in the gospel message and those who still held to the old Catholic idea of salvation as mediated through the church's sacraments, the so-called High Church and the Puritans. The struggle between these parties in the Church of England is a long and tortuous one. Some people got fed up with it and decided they had to leave the Church of England. It was never going to be resolved. The Church of England was never going to be fully reformed. And they began to form groups, of which the Baptists were one, the independent churches, as they later became known. But there were others who stuck with it in the Church of England, believing that the Church of England could be fully reformed eventually. But always that Anglo-Catholic wing survived. It was never lost. And eventually, when after a couple of hundred years of struggle, a settlement was finally agreed, these two wings were clearly identifiable within the Church of England. The Protestant wing that accepted Luther's ideas, and the Anglo-Catholic wing, which still looked to the Church of Rome for its theological direction. And the ironic thing is that last weekend, after 300 years, that muddle, in a sort of way, came home to roost. For you see, the priesthood is the key for a Catholic. The person who is empowered to say those words of consecration over the bread and wine, that is a key role. It is to hold the way of salvation in your hands for sinners. And for those who follow the Church of Rome's view, that such an office in the church must be male, because the 12 apostles were male, and only passed their authority on to male bishops and priests. Those who hold that view of the Church of Rome on a male priesthood just cannot accept, it is impossible in their view, that a woman could execute that role in the church, which is the key role in the church. That's why it was such an emotive issue for them, you see, because they still clung to a Catholic view of the way of salvation. And that's why, of course, people who did that left the Church of England to go to Rome. You could say they were just 300 years too late. They should have been there long ago. if they still adhered to that sacramentalist theology of Rome. I have to tell you, though, that it's my view and it's the view of the church here at Eden, that Luther was right in this matter. That medieval doctrine of salvation was fundamentally mistaken. It was a distortion, a caricature of the message of the gospel which Jesus and the apostles brought. If one wants to look for reasons for it, why that distortion crept in, I think it had to do fundamentally with the need for the church to establish its power. It had to do with power over people. And power is best served by reserving to yourself certain authorities which nobody else can have. The authority to forgive sins is a big stick to wave over any monarch or duke or emperor who doesn't quite go the way the church thinks he ought to go. It was in the interests of the church to have a strongly sacramentalist theology, which gave to the institutional church this huge power. But it was wrong. At least it seems to me quite clear from the Bible, it was wrong. And that Luther's discovery was a discovery. It wasn't the invention of some new theology. It was a rediscovery of what the Christian message had always been. You may say, well, so really we're on the side of the Church of England then, and not on the side of those dissidents who have gone over to the Church of Rome. We at Eden ought to be supporting the Church of England in the ordination of women then. Is that right? Ah, alas, you see, the issue is still more complicated yet. For the irony is, the Bible does distinguish male and female roles in the church. The Bible does seem to say, at least you can make a very strong case for saying that the Bible says, that there are certain roles in the church which are restricted to men. St. Paul does seem to teach that. And it is true, Jesus appointed 12 male apostles, not a woman among them. Now, it is possible, of course, to argue that that was simply a concession to contemporary first century culture. But I suspect it is unlikely it was. And at least one must respect, greatly respect those who regard this as a fundamental reflection of something which is built into the nature of men and women as God intended them to be, a role distinction. But the interesting thing is when you read the New Testament, that role which is restricted to men has nothing to do with saying magic words over bread and wine. The role which is restricted to men in the New Testament is the office of teacher. It wasn't that Paul forbade women to say prayers at the communion service. Certainly not that he forbade them to hand out the plates and the cup. No such restriction is found in the New Testament at all. The only restriction the New Testament lays upon the role of a woman in the church is that of the authoritative teacher of the church. Now, as I say, there's plenty of room for argument about exactly what that means in practical terms. And there is a real debate, a real controversy, and we at Eden have shared in that. It isn't straightforward to know how we should translate those biblical principles into the contemporary life of late 20th century Christian churches. But that is where the real controversy lies. The ironic thing is, women have been allowed to preach in the Church of England for decades, and nobody has ever argued about it. No question has ever been raised about it in synod. The extraordinary thing is that the big argument, the big schism has taken place over whether a woman should be allowed to say a prayer over the bread and wine, something which makes no contact with biblical Christianity at all. What lessons, then, can we draw from this extraordinary story? I'll just mention three. The first lesson I think we ought to draw from this whole sad business of the Church of England tearing itself apart over this issue is this. We must recognize that some doctrinal issues are much more important than others. We must have a sense of priority and proportion in evaluating controversies about doctrine in the church. I tell you frankly, if the choice came to me as an ordinary Christian living in a town or a village somewhere of either attending a church where there was a male priest offering a sacramentalist view of salvation through ritual, on the one hand, and a female pastor in a gospel church preaching justification by faith, on the other hand, I would be in that lady's congregation every Sunday. Because the issue of the way of salvation is hugely more important than this vexed question of male and female roles. You and I are never going to find a church which we don't find some point of disagreement about somewhere along the line. In weighing up where we should throw our energies, where we should identify ourselves as church members, it's important to have a sense of proportion and priority. The second thing I would say, by way of learning a lesson from all this debate in the Church of England, is that it is never wise to settle for theological compromise over fundamental issues of salvation in a church. As I say, the Church of England is really only reaping what it has sowed. I hope I don't sound patronizing or pompous about that, but it is reaping the folly of its own history right now in trying to wed together within its structure two fundamentally incompatible ways of people getting saved. Sacramentalist theology and gospel justification by faith theology are not compatible. They are different ways whereby the grace of Christ is mediated to the individual. And they're not consistent with one another. You're either one or the other. Church of England, by trying to wed them together in this compromise way, has just been storing up for itself trouble. And the miracle for me is that it's taken so many centuries for them to discover it. And the third lesson I would draw, well, here perhaps I am severely in danger of being a bit chauvinistic about my own denominational roots. I would say one of the things I have learned as a sort of spectator of all this debate going on in the Church of England is to perceive again the wisdom of local church independency. Oh, I am not saying that churches like Eden don't have their faults, don't have their frustrations. They have plenty. You come to me in private and I will give you a long list of all the frustrations of churches that are governed on the sort of way that this church is governed, as an independent local church that does not look to any central bureaucracy, any central magisterium for its direction, which ordains its own elders, appoints its own pastors. But for all the frustrations and difficulties which such churches do incur, I have been made aware, very much aware, that if one must talk of the lesser of two evils, independency is definitely it. See, the Church of Rome and the Church of England do have one thing in common, even if you accept the Protestant pedigree doctrinally of the Church of England as being intact. They both believe that the church, with a capital C, should have a centralized organization. Ordination in the Church of England and in the Church of Rome both lie in the hands of bishops. Bishops who are not appointed by the congregations, but by the head of the church. In the case of the Church of Rome, that is the Pope, and in the case of the Church of England, it is the monarch. Doctrinal controversies in such highly centralized churches inevitably pose huge problems because of the need to achieve uniformity across the entire denomination. Schism and division are always a danger, and compromise always inevitable. But it seems to me, when you look in the New Testament, you do not find any evidence at all of a church with a capital C as a central organization directing the affairs of other congregations. When in the New Testament you find the word church in that singular with the definite article, the church, it always has in mind the great body of redeemed Christians, redeemed people. Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. But Paul isn't thinking there of some central office in Rome or Lambeth or anywhere else. He's thinking of the great body of redeemed people, perhaps even thinking of them in glory, as a kind of final, last-time reality gathered around the Lamb, celebrating the one who died for them. That's the only way the church, with the definite article and the capital C, is used in the New Testament. Wherever else you find the word church, it is used, as it were, with a small c and usually plural. the churches. Because the only earthly manifestation of that great company of God's people, which have been redeemed through Christ, the only earthly manifestation of it that the New Testament knows is local congregations, local churches, churches which are not affiliated to some central bureaucracy. Indeed, the apostles go out of their way not to set up any such centralized bureaucracy. Churches which appoint their own leaders, recognize their own problems and solve them, and are responsible before God directly for the doctrine that they teach. Of course, a church like Eden, which is constituted in that way as an independent local church, can make mistakes. Maybe on this question of the role of women in the church, we have got it wrong. It's quite possible. We're not infallible. We understand the Bible the best we know how. We pray for God's direction through His Spirit the best we can, but we make mistakes. The only advantage we have is if we do make mistakes, at least we're the only people who suffer from them. At least we are not trying to adjudicate the conscience of the whole of Christendom. If we make mistakes, we are the people who carry the can for the mistakes we make within our own local fellowship. We don't transmit those mistakes like a virus to everybody else. But if the Church of England makes mistakes, if bishops make mistakes, if the Pope makes a mistake, the effects are quite disastrous. I was traveling on the train a couple of weeks ago when this issue was just beginning to appear in the newspapers, and by chance I met an Anglican friend of mine. And inevitably, he pointed to the article on the front page and said, what do you think about all this then? I said to him, do you know, the truth is, it makes me so very glad I'm a Baptist.